Welcome to the Alarpa Podcast. Joining me in studio is the irrepressible Mary. How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
Irrepressible and irreplaceable. Feels like a lifetime ago that I was flying solo on this podcast mission. In fact, I did so last Sunday for the story time edition of the podcast. If you haven't checked it out, do check it out. And at the top of the show, I would make a few recommendations as well. Potter Rooney with Joe Rooney. That's still a great podcast. This new episode this week. And a few others of your favourites. But apart from podcast recommendations, which should be kept until the end of the show. So this introduction is getting a little bit bungled. You've been at a conference for Egyptian things this week on Wednesday, no?
Yeah, it was just a talk.
And what was the talk about?
About the UNESCO mission to save the Nubian monuments in the 70s.
Okay.
60s and 70s.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because in class today I was reading quotes about neoliberalism, and one such quote was, "We had a rebellion in the 50s, 60s, and early parts of the 70s. The rest you can keep." So would you view this battle to save these cultural sites as part of a wider paradigm of cultural rebellion? Or was it just its own archaeological focus?
Well, it was the fact that they were going to be completely swallowed by water.
Okay, so a little bit different. I'm just
conflating
two issues here. But there is an interesting thing about Egypt that I actually taught you, and you have a PhD on the issue.
I don't have a PhD on beer.
No, on Egypt.
Yes, you told me about beer.
Well, you live in Newcastle. You probably drank enough to earn a PhD. What's that? What's Strongbow? Is that your poison?
Yes, beer that was made from... That's cider anyway, I'm confused.
Is it cider?
Yeah, Strongbow is
cider. Strongbow, okay, well...
So that's why... And yes... I did like it so much.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Beer made from stale bread.
Yeah, that's an ancient Egyptian technique. I've seen a report about it, because in a bakery in Belgium, as a protest against food waste, they're using stale bread to make beer, basically, and they bottle it. In the bakery, and they put the labels on manually and everything as well. It's a little bit expensive, I think. I'm not sure about the price, but even the makers themselves say it's more of a niche product. It's not going to appeal to everybody, really. But they're doing it because, well, it's an old tradition. It's something that you can do. It does create a particular flavor in the beer. And as I say, it's like an ecological protest to show how much food is wasted and how you can reuse it, because it's a bakery, and they say maybe every day there'll be a few buns or whatever left over, but every week, every month, that tends to add up. So they want to kind of repurpose that in a more positive way. So that's why we were talking about it this week. This is like a modern news story, because it's happening in Belgium at the moment. And I'm sure, you know, Belgium is the home of beer, so they must know what they're doing when it comes to crafting the full body and full flavor of a beer over there. But speaking of ancient Egypt, have you ever come across this in your PhD hunting of hard bread being made into beer?
Not that I can remember, to be honest.
No?
Not really.
Okay, well...
There's a lot of evidence for like beer making, but I don't... It's more like models that depict people making beer, but it doesn't go into the specifics of showing stale bread, of course.
Oh, really?
Maybe something I know and I don't remember, but I don't think so.
Because bread was everywhere in ancient Egypt. It was currency, so...
So was beer.
So was beer. Speaking of beer, also, you must be familiar with the cult of Bacchus. Is there an Egyptian equivalent of this god? Are you like Cifuentes? Do you have a fake PhD?
Well, I can't think of a relation on the top of my head. Well, it's the god of fun. Well, you could think like Bes, for example, who's the dead dwarf. he's related to, you know, like mischief and things like that.
Okay, well, the reason I mentioned that is because, well, before I explain that, Cifuentes, if you don't know, if your international audience, is a Madrid politician from the Conservative Party who was caught in a lie about her master's degree. She doesn't have one, basically, and she said she attended classes that she never attended, and her tutors or lecturers have no recollection of actually teaching her. Of course, it's a developing story in Spain. And you know it's a developing story in Spain when it pops up in The Guardian as well. So it kind of surpasses the national boundaries of Spain and becomes international news. As a politically aware person, I'm sure you're very surprised and shocked and appalled by this emerging news story.
Well, I'm surprised about her in particular because she seemed to be the only one in her party who was trying to fight corruption and denouncing other people for corruption. But then again, I don't know, like, we're so used to things happening here and then they all go unpunished to that. It's
par for the course.
Yeah.
Well, why I mentioned Bacchus is because I was reading another article about how basically losing your mind and, you know, and drink and partying and everything. And ecstasy is a Greek conception that literally means kind of outside of yourself. And it was like Bacchus became like a gender fluid, very adaptable religious figure, of course, that we all know and about from being the kind of god of excess and hedonism in its own way. And there's a very interesting cultural article about how like this became like a social need, because even in prehistory, we needed each other for survival and to create social bonds, as it does now, to loosen tongues and to loosen inhibitions. They drank a lot, for example. So since we mentioned beer, I thought maybe perhaps there might be an Egyptian equivalent of this god. But it's an interesting article that you can find in the BBC if you go to the culture section. But that's it for part one. We'll be back in part two with more chinwaggery. So cue, Mary, the musical interlude. Part two of the show. So, you had a moment of Irish glory this week.
You mean because I saw a sentence and I translated it? Well, it wasn't even a sentence, it was just a...
On the old tweet machine, no?
Yeah.
Do you remember the phrase?
But I remember the phrase, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to pronounce it properly.
Give it a go.
On
Farmarov, exactly. So this is a post on Twitter.
Yeah.
In relation to?
The Sleeping Giant. It's a rock in West Kerry.
West Kerry, next to the Gaeltacht region, which is an Irish-speaking area.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a rock for me. Well, it's a
well in the sea.
It's a lump of rock off the coast, and it looks like a dead man, or Fionn MacCool, who's an Irish hero in repose, or in English, sometimes the translation isn't a dead man. Coming from Farmarov, it's the sleeping man, no?
The sleeping giant.
Or the sleeping giant, for example. Yeah. And it's quite remarkable. If you check it out on, if you just Google it, you'll be able to find really stunning photographs of it taken at different times of the day. Google, because their new algorithm, I think some photo websites, you know, like those royalty-free, like Shutterstock, for example, were complaining that it was too easy to download photographs from Google. So they made it a little bit difficult to do it, but it's just a bit more awkward, but it's actually still very easy to do it. So if you like one and you want to download it, don't let Google stop you with their new way of doing it. It's actually very simple. So that was your moment of Irish glory. You mentioned cider in part one.
Yeah, well, you mentioned cider, thinking it was beer.
Strongbow, yeah. I know it from the Leeds sponsorship. They used to sponsor Leeds United back in the day when they actually were a decent team under the tutelage of Dave O'Leary.
Okay.
So that's, apart from a little bit in Patriots, this is the last football I mentioned in the podcast. So it's very unusual to have that. But
how do you know what's going to happen in part three?
Because I have a good feeling about part three. I think I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
A little bit because we have the gift of foresight.
Yes, you can see a future.
And also because we also recorded it before part two.
Well,
so as we let that secret out in the last episode, so I think they're on to us now regarding that little aspect of our recording schedule. But no, the reason I mentioned the cider is because now we've been mentioning podcasts and other podcasts, and I have to mention the weekly obligatory Blind Boy Book Club of the Rubber Bandits podcast. And he had a very, very interesting story though about how Johnny Jump Up is an Irish traditional song, and it's when it was published at a time and sang at a time when cider wasn't very popular in Ireland. People didn't really take to it. So a company who made a brand of cider paid a musician to write a song and then sing it in pubs around Ireland. So it would make that type of drink very popular. And that's what happened. So and the lyrics are basically about how someone gets drunk. And it wasn't me that did it. It was cider. I didn't punch the cop. It was cider, for example. So it's kind of like a tongue-in-cheek song. Because a lot of Irish folk songs, and he mentioned this in the podcast, aren't actually about love. They're about the kind of surreal, over-exaggerated in the style of Irish storytelling. And frequently about the kind of the excesses of alcohol consumption. Not in a, don't drink alcohol kind of way, and more it's great crack kind of way. So that's kind of the story behind that. So just a square the circle there on the cider chat from part one, which I do know about because it happened in the past. So I don't need any gift of foresight there. So we're going to talk about language today and slang in particular. Now you are linguistically gifted. Your English is flawless.
Well, I wouldn't say
you got a high score in the history of England on the C2 proficiency Cambridge exam.
History of England?
Or something like that. I don't know. What was it? The highest mark ever in Spade or whatever? In the history of the examination.
It's all like my dad. It's all it is that is the highest score you can get, and then you've made it into is the highest score in Spain or something.
Oh, you're the highest score in Spain?
No, of course it isn't.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Yeah, well, we'll just assume it is. And also, you speak a little bit of Irish, as evidenced by your Farmore chat at the part two there.
Oh, yeah.
And also, you obviously speak Spanish, being a native.
Yeah, very often.
And a little bit of Arabic, and a little bit of French, for example. So, morally, philosophically, socially, where do you stand on the topic of slang?
You're really distracting me with that preamble, I wasn't expecting that question.
Well, see, it's not a question you have to prepare for, because you hear slang every day, and you'll know what your honest and instinctive reaction to it is. So what is your honest and instinctive reaction to it?
Well, I don't know. Can you have a particular stand on slang?
Well, yes, you can. You can, because there's a Guardian debate, which is 5 minutes long. They did a series called the 5 Minute Debate, and you obviously have two people who are arguing the opposite sides of the same issue, and of course this one was about slang. So you had a guy called Lindsay who was virulently anti-slang, and that's actually a man's name. I know an Australian called Lindsay as well. So. Anyway, names can be anything now. Sure, my name is gender fluid, like Bacchus mentioned in part one as well. And also, apart from that, well, now you distracted me. Nice one. And then an older gentleman from called Michael, who is he's not exactly arguing in favor of slang, but I think he has a much more open mind about it, and he can really see its value. He doesn't think it's a great force that can block someone's progress, and also he can see how he should manage it. And again, as I said just a little bit ago, it's culture, it's place in our common culture, for example. So now the guy Lindsay, and yes, it is a man in case you're still wondering, his opening statement is, Michael, slang is anathema to me. Now, anathema is an interesting word because it comes from the Spanish Inquisition. And it's the same in Spanish, anathema, just without the H. And it's 50-50 whether Spanish students will actually know the word, because anathema is a word that again, I've seen it in this debate, and I've heard it in this debate, but the first time I ever came across this was in a video game from the Hitman series. The first chapter of the first game on PS2 was like Anathema. Obviously, I looked it up and I learned what it was. It's something that's repugnant. It's like something that's the opposite of sacred. It's almost a sin. So that's why he's saying it's anathema to me. Slang is like a sin to me. It's like a transgression. And as I say, it comes from the Spanish Inquisition. So it's a very interesting word for that in its root. And as I say, it's the same in Spanish. Now, with slang as well, it's a bit weird because like certain slang that you can use with Spanish students depends on the generation and where they come from, for example. Because speaking of Blind Boy Book Club, I've been doing a lesson with about him in a sense this week. I've been showing a picture of him with his...
He should plug us in the amount of money you do for
him. He doesn't need it. He's like number one in Ireland for like
yeah,
the last
but we do.
21 weeks. Yeah, it's true. I doubt he listens to this though. But if he does, well, that'd be nice. From one Limerick man to another. But no, I've been showing a picture of his face with his... And if you don't know him, well, you do obviously. But for the listeners that don't, he wears a paper bag over his face, like a shopping bag from a supermarket. So, I don't know, from Tesco or whatever, or in Spain, Dia or Supercore. And the reactions to that have been widespread. And I said, maybe he looks to you like a cani in Spanish. You know what I'm talking about. A cani and a chani, you know?
Okay, yes.
Yeah, which is kind of a slang term. So I'm just trying to relate to them. But, you know, I was actually surprised that a lot of, well, not a lot of students, but maybe half of the students didn't know actually what I was talking about. Some of them did in the same class, and others didn't. So I've heard it's a generational thing that only young people say it. It's a southern Spanish thing.
It's a local thing, yeah. It's a regional thing as well.
It's a regional thing as well. So it's a word like I've always known from like almost day one here in Spain. So
which one, cani or chani?
Well, chani more than cani.
Yeah,
but so chani has more widespread.
I would say in Spain, yes. Sorry, in Spain, no, in Madrid.
Yeah, but cani is for a male and chani is for a girl though.
Yes, but yes, cani for me has a connotation.
Well, that's the thing, it does have a connotation.
Yes, that is.
And if you don't, so yeah, it would be remiss of us not to explain what that is. It's going to be difficult to do that, but basically, I think every culture has their people who wear tracksuits and have a bad reputation, whether it's deserved or not. And they're seen by some as lacking culture and lacking education.
Yeah.
And in English, if you're talking about London English or English from the country England, maybe pikey would be a good translation, maybe, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
With the same connotation.
Yeah, so it's slang, it's pejorative, basically.
Yes.
And so that's why I was using that word, because like his look, his getup is kind of like... like that. It's kind of tapping into that culture. It's a bit aggressive maybe, but like as I said, like not a lot of people knew that word. So again, so you know, we're establishing that slang can be regional, it's generational, and it is of the people speaking it. So, and that would be depending, you know, on different groups, middle-aged, male, female, perhaps rich, poor, center of Spain, southern Spain, northern Spain, for example.
Yeah.
Now, he believes that, Lindsay, that is, that it blocks the progress because you don't have people like David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister at the time that the debate was happening. Of course, Theresa May would be the person now, or Ed Miliband. You know, they don't speak slang. So those in the corridors of power do not speak slang. So if you speak slang, you will be screwed in the university entrance exam or the job interview, and you're going to be prejudiced against society. Now, there's a lot we can talk about that, but...
Yes, I disagree.
You disagree. I also disagree, but can you tell me why you do?
Well, because slang is not a matter of whether you speak slang or you don't speak slang. It's a matter of register. So the correct thing for me is to know what register to use depending on the situation. So to say that, for example, David Cameron doesn't speak slang, well, I don't know what he speaks like in his private life, but surely, or most likely, although, well, maybe that's not the best example, the Tories, but, you know, people speak differently in their private life and they will use a language and allow themselves certain things that they wouldn't do in public, and that's the right thing to do for me. I mean, I don't speak the same way I speak slang with my friends, but then I wouldn't speak slang with my parents or or you know, or certain things that might be seen as too colloquial, or
yeah, well,
I wouldn't swear in front of them, but I would with my friends.
Yeah,
it depends who you're talking to.
Well, Michael, who is the open-minded older gentleman, and that blew the mind of the students. They're like, we thought the old guy would be against slang.
Yeah,
topsy-turvy world. But he said, well, this is called code switching. So basically, the ability. He says there's no evidence to suggest that we can't be bi-dialectal, which means that, you know, switching from slang to more standard forms of a language, whether it be Spanish, French, or English, or whatever. And
it's a skill, really.
Yeah, well, it's actually a very interesting scene in The Departed, which is Martin Scorsese's movie. Mark Wahlberg and Leonardo DiCaprio are two Irish American characters, and Mark Wahlberg kind of has a go at Leonardo DiCaprio for being like a lace curtain Irish motherfucker. I think that's a could be a direct quote, or if it's not, it's a paraphrasing what he said to him. Basically, he accused him of being like one type of Irish American at the weekends. Because his parents were divorced, so whoever he was with at the weekends, he was kind of more posh and laddie there. And during the week with the other parent, he's a bit more rough and tumble because he was going to a kind of rougher neighborhood. So he used that as a stick to beat him with when he first was introduced to him, in a way to kind of test his mettle. It's kind of a funny scene in the movie because Leonardo DiCaprio is in an interview and he's trying very hard not to react to that, but then he gets very angry, and Martin Sheen kind of steps in as the kind of good cop and kind of settles the two boys down. But you're right, though. This is a skill that we all have.
Not
all people have, but it's a useful skill. Lindsay says, though, that when we're under stress and pressure, we revert to the norm. So if we use slang more than standard Spanish or English, under pressure, we will start using slang, which will prejudice our ability and our petition to be, you know, in a job interview or in a university interview, for example. Now, he also said, like, the people in corridors of power don't speak slang. And there's two things to say about this. One from Michael that I agree with, and one that I think is my opinion as well. Michael says that, everybody speaks slang. You know, David Cameron speaks an Eton slang. That's the school he went to. So he speaks a posh person's slang, like a privately educated person's slang. So the idea is that we all have slang. So even different classes and rich and poor, within their groups and subgroups, they have their particular lexicon, and it's a mistake to think that only people who speak, you know, in a posh way perhaps don't speak slang. And also as well, he's saying, like, because the people from the corridors of power don't speak that way, that would prejudice you. But that would probably speak more of the prejudice of those people who speak in a certain way and how they have that prejudice towards perhaps lower classes. Even though I think, to take a step back, I think I've observed prejudice going both ways. If you speak a lot of slang, you might have a prejudice for those who speak more standard English, and of course people who speak standard English can have a prejudice for people who speak from the barrio or from the neighborhood. But also as well, I think it's a big mistake, obviously, because, like, you know, we know from Spain, you know, the ponytail, Podemos, you know, Pablo Iglesias, like, how when he first came into the parliament, he spoke in the street way, and how that was very shocking for kind of straight-laced conservatives. But now it's very normal, so it doesn't take long, I think, for society to kind of adjust itself to accepting a politician to speak like that. But even more, you know, just because you have someone like David Cameron who's speaking a certain way, you know, he still screwed his country several ways, and his last act of screwing the country, of course, was the Brexit vote. So, you know, people speak very nice and dandy and very in a very well-educated way, but a lot of these career politicians do great damage. So, you know, this idea that a certain accent or a certain way of speaking that excludes slang kind of gives you maybe more moral standing or more credibility, I think is obviously a false one, because when you look at it in reality, a lot of politicians, and including David Cameron, have done a lot of bad with the power that they've been given.
Yeah, I think it's just completely foolish to think there's any relation between, you know, people speaking correctly. It's a similar relation to thinking, although that happened a lot in Spain, to assuming that people that have had a good upbringing and are well educated and went to, like, good institutions are going to be ethically flawless, which I think is one of the syndromes that we have, and the reason why we keep on falling for the lies that we do, in this case.
Cifuentes.
Well, for example, yeah.
who we mentioned in part one, and yeah. The master's debacle. And in the second half of the debate, so it's a 5-minute debate, I think Lindsay just kind of really repeats that mantra while Michael talks about how Shakespeare used the word cuz, and that how, you know, it's like primo in Spanish, or even like if you went to the streets of London, or if you're watching a bad Guy Ritchie movie, you probably see people going cuz, you know. And he said Shakespeare used that quite a lot, so slang, you know, it does become, you know, is used by popular culture, and can, you know, it's part of how we speak, so it's a very fundamental thing. And also, I think he wins the bit by saying, like, you cannot ban language, because, like, we've tried to do that so many times with dialects. He mentions Geordie, Cockney, because obviously they're speaking in English context. And he says that, like, language always survives. So we have to understand why people speak in a certain way and say, look, why doesn't David Cameron speak this way? Or look, this is The Guardian. Why don't people speak or write in the way that you're speaking? And kind of get them to understand that, you know, you have this code switching, and you can switch from one form of speaking to another depending on the context, for example. And that's, I think it's very true, you can't ban language. I know in France, it, like, De Gaulle after World War II wanted to ban, like, the Breton language and kind of other dialects. Obviously in Spain you have, like, the Catalonian and Basque languages. Did that happen with other languages? I know, because, like, you know, you have Leonese, you kind of, like, these dialects from different regions.
Yeah.
Was that also in the crosshairs of Franco?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. Yes. Well, and it still is to a point, because there's no effort is made to try and preserve these languages and these dialects, and quite the opposite. Like, I'm talking now about, for example, Leonese, or...
Yeah,
you know, that Bable, that the dialects that are very small, but you know, apart from, like, the old local initiatives, there's no interest or barely mentioned in the textbooks, and that's it.
Yeah, so. But for example, like has there been a political groundswelling of, you know, obviously Catalan language became very politicized, and you know, Basque as well. The people who spoke Leonese or other dialects, did they attach that to a political identity or a political opposition to the state as it was, or was it just a sense of well, we're going to we'll speak it with the grandparents in the house, and, you know, we don't agree with it, but we're not going to kick up too much of a fuss about it. But, you know, the language will survive in the kitchens and in the living room.
Well, no, because, for example, in the case of Leon, it goes hand in hand with the places becoming, you know, people leaving the regions because of there being no work,
yeah,
and moving from the countryside to the big cities, and just losing all that population. So with that population moving, also the language disappears, the traditions. So it's just basically it's integrating the whole individuality of the culture.
Now there's also one other aspect that we can, I know you have to go, and if you whisper it, the microphone will still pick it up.
Pick it up when I speak properly, never mind when I whisper.
Okay, don't worry, I'm well aware of that, so this is the last thing I'll say to you. Backslang in France, a lot of immigrants, they invert their words so the police won't understand them. Maybe Cockney has that origin as well. So I think as well, you know, I think it's a mistake to view slang in a very narrow way, in a very reductive way, to see it's like a form of not being educated, because very often language, and actually probably most of the time or all the time, language responds to real needs within the community. So if you have an immigrant community that maybe doesn't feel safe or feels targeted by the police, which can happen, that's why you have kind of like slang and different ways of speaking, for example. So a very simple yes or no, has this happened in the Spanish language?
Yes.
It has. Okay. So, well, we'll leave it there. So,
okay.
So now it's, if you're interested in that topic, you can find The Guardian Debate. And also, as well, if you want to just Google street slang or backslang, as I mentioned in France, and we've just heard very, very briefly there in Spain as well, you can find out more information for yourself. So that's part two. On to the part three, which is already recorded. So we're off to the point. I'm off to the bar. You're going home. And tune in next week. Or actually, no. Go to part three. I'll say that next. I'll say that in the next part. Okay. that was part two. This is part three. Not much to say here. Just as I said at the start of the show, check out Joe Rudy's Podaroony, where he has a fascinating interview with a YouTuber, a podcaster, and they talk about running in a very Irish way, mental health, meditation, guruism, and different things like that. I thought it was interesting. BBC World Service, not that I need any plugs from us, of course, but some fascinating episodes lately. Always fascinating, but particularly so now. So any plugs you want to get in?
I'll check out our tours and...
Oh, our plugs. Yeah, of course.
Well, yeah, the most important ones, I
yeah.
was thought.
Yes, LARPA1 on Twitter. Instagram is LARPA Media. LARPAmedia.com is our website. LARPA Media on YouTube as well. And Audio Boom, Stitcher, iTunes. Well, you're already listening to the podcast, so... this is actually,
this.
Yeah, and I always forget how redundant the podcast plug is since you're already listening. But if you're just wondering if it's available on other platforms,
well, in case
it
you fancy listening somewhere else to see if it's the same or
the layout is kind of different on different platforms. I like it in some, not so much in others, but what can you do? So, by the time you listen to this, the draw for the Champions League will have been made as well. So, hopefully, Liverpool get a nice tie, which is actually difficult because all the teams are very strong.
Do you want me to be in Madrid?
Oh, that'd be great, actually. I could go see the match, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It costs a fortune.
I'd still go, though. And I could see how the referee would engineer a soft penalty for Madrid in the last kick of the game.
Yet again.
That would be amazing to see. Well, so all those football folks and those who don't care for the sport, and for all those listening to our podcast, have a great week. We'll be back next week with another scheduled episode of the Elaborate Podcast and surprise you every now and then with a bonus episode. And as I said at the start of the show, if you haven't checked it out already, check out our Story Time, which is a podcast where we just talk about a story that we've written. And also, you can also, if you really like that and all our other stuff on Patreon, you can find us on Elaborate Media as well. And buy us a cup of coffee. That's what they always say in other podcasts. Buy us, give us enough money for a cup of coffee. Each month, it's
buys a meal
or a beer. No. So you have to break it down into months. But everybody buys you like the just like a price of a beer per month.
Yeah,
it all adds up to maybe 3 beers at the end of the month. judging on how many patrons we have. Yeah. So that's it. So saying good book, good luck,
and goodbye.
And goodbye. The LARPA Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.